The proposed tax cuts that were the proposals that were made by the bipartisan panel last week to cut the deficit targets $4 trillion. But does anyone have the stomach to implement it? And if they don't, what could that mean? And finally, when did this debt really start? Joining us now to talk about this and the implication it's going to have for you, your children, and your grandchildren. First up, she's the director of MyGovCost.com and the Our Government Cost Calculator. She's also a professor of economics at San Jose State University and the director of the Center on Entrepreneurial Innovation at the Independent Institute. Emily Scarback joins us today on Matt in the Middle. Emily?
Hello.
Also with us, he's a former strategist for the Democratic Party, but now plies his craft, a very skillful one, I might add, as an activist for a little-known group you may have heard of who feel they have been taxed enough already, the acronym for the Tea Party movement. Tom Avitabile joins us on Matt in the Middle. Tom?
Good morning. How are you?
Doing great.
Great.
These proposals put together by these 18 commissioners are quite chewy, to say the least. A lot of stuff, raising Social Security retirement to 69 while reducing scheduled benefits, slashing the Pentagon budget, cutting farm subsidies, eliminating earmarks, eliminating the child tax credit, mortgage interest deduction, the income tax credit, raising gasoline taxes by 15 cents, just to name a few. Right off the bat, as a conservative, Tom, which of these things do you think has the best chance of flying, if pigs fly?
Well, it's the cost of pig that's the issue here. Just a couple of disclaimers before we go in. This is a preliminary leak on a commission. This is not the final report, and I think it was a trial balloon set up by a bunch of politicians who are on the commission who don't know any other way to do it. I don't think there's actually going to be anything that comes out of this report because the two guys that released it, Erskine Bowles and Simpson, I think felt that the commission was going another way. And are either trying to force the commission to toe the line that they want or are using it as a trial balloon to see what the reaction of the public is to kind of soften the target before they come out with draconian measures. But I think you got to take a step back and you've got to look at, you know, why this commission even exists. This commission exists because of the failure of Congress to enact some really tougher which would be more decisive cuts as an instrument of Congress, and was a negotiated thing by Obama, President Obama, who said, okay, you pass $1.9 trillion in deficits, and I'll put a commission in. So it's a political cover operation to begin with. So we're really down the funnel here of what the actual import of their report means. And it's only to the gravitas of the two gentlemen that leaked the report that I think we're all talking about it, but they're not scheduled to actually bring the report until December 1st. So everything in this report is essentially meaningless at this point because it doesn't carry the official stamp, and it is a unanimous vote. So I think there's a majority Democrat.
Well, they only need 14 of 18. It's near a majority, but not quite.
Oh, I heard it was unanimous, that they all had to agree on everything. But the point is that you've also got people that, like Andy Stern on the commission. And if you know anything about Andy Stern, he bankrupted his own party, his own union's pension plan. So, he's on the commission. So I don't know, you know, what Obama used as a yardstick for deciding who gets on the commission. But it just seems to me that you're looking for the same result. There's nobody on there that's really got a handle on how we got here. They're all actually, many of them, part of the reason why we are here.
Well, let's talk about that, Emily. This deficit that we're talking about here, it didn't start with the Obama administration. When did it go from zero? When did it start to go from zero? And can you give us a timeline on how we got here?
Well, sure. The deficit has been building for many different years. I think what's interesting, to speak to the other guest comment about the political feasibility of the proposal that's been put forth. I agree wholeheartedly that this is just the beginning, and this is just kind of to wet the public's taste buds for some of the possible reforms that we may see down the line. But what I think is interesting that people aren't talking about is that the particular reforms proposed in this provides a lot of political leverage both for the right and the left to take advantage of. One important aspect is that the proposal doesn't make any significant changes to the president's health care package that has been pushed through, which would provide a very strong anchoring point for the Democrats to take hold of this policy.
And well, what about the right? So what then? You said you mentioned them. So what about the other side? What is it an advantage for them to take it to look at?
Well, in essence, if we're going to do anything about this ongoing deficit and the debt writ large, we're going to need to make cuts in the spending, you know, one way or another. And in particularly, we need to make cuts and changes to our mandatory dedicated payments of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. So some of the most significant changes that we see coming out of this bill are these modest proposals to push back the retirement age by a couple of years, to make some changes in pegging Medicare to GDP, which again are quite reasonable, and really addressing the issue of taxes. I mean, from an economic standpoint, the most fundamental insight of the economics is that people respond to incentives, and tax rates are one of the clearest examples of this. When you have high tax rates, you see reduced work effort, you see reduced investment, and you see lower productivity growth over time. And so if the Deficit Commission is going to do anything to really tackle the long-term crisis that we see looming here, they're going to have to implement long-lasting economic policies that are based on long-term strategies and not short-term quick fixes.
Tom, you were going to say something?
Well, one thing I wanted to point out is that since your show went on the air 25 minutes ago, the national debt has risen $40 million in that time. And you can check that by the debt clock. But I think that's where we start to lose sight of this thing. I think what's necessary is I think this is beyond the Congress. I think this is actually even beyond the government at this point. I think what we all have to realize is for the last 30 years, America has been living on a credit card. And from that aspect of being on the credit card, we have inflated everything about our lives. There used to be a commercial with a guy saying, I belong to a yacht club, and I have a home, and I have this and the other thing, and then he's riding his tractor mower, and he's saying, somebody help me, because he's so trapped in the debt cycle. And I think that's where America is right now. We have actually caused this. I mean, the politicians really just respond to what we want, but what happened ultimately is we all took from this. Now, some took more than others. But we've all incurred this debt. We've all incurred this debt from a question of the unfunded liabilities. I mean, $13 trillion is nothing in terms of what is admitted to be our national debt. And let's remember, $13 trillion is by some new innovative formula of GDP, which doesn't really reflect what the real actual debt is. But even if you buy that number, that $13 trillion, according to the CBO, in 2015, if you follow the CBO, it's going to be $17 trillion. But if you look at the way it's growing right now, forget the CBO, it's $24 trillion. So this is a massive kind of trough that we've all been feeding at. And the only way it's going to change is if Americans in total say, you know what? Yeah, we need to pay our bills. And
right. So if America then is addicted, what you're describing sounds like addiction. So if Americans are addicted to debt, and they are addicted to there are some of these things in these proposals which are dead on arrival, like Social Security. Political careers have gone toe up in the history of this country since the inception of Social Security. Anybody going after it, they don't really last very long.
But that's
so,
because we train them that way, Gary. I mean,
right.
I'm not to interrupt,
but
to my point is American people have to decide that this is too much, and then tell government what to do, which again goes back to, I guess, the Tea Party idea.
They're
incapable of doing it.
I think for many Americans, it's very hard for them to conceptualize what $13.3 trillion means for them personally. And so this is one of the things that we've taken up at the Independent Institute in developing this new tool for taxpayers. It's called mygovcost.org. Essentially, what users can do is come in and plug in their information, and the calculator will take all of these CBO projections and OMB projections and debt projections and calculate them down to the individual level. So users can find out what they pay in annual taxes, how those taxes are likely to change into the future, and moreover, they can find out what the value of those dollars would be worth if they could otherwise not pay for particular spending programs and invest them in the stock market.
That sounds wonderful.
And so what we have available is a measure for our taxpayers, for citizens to come in and really have a very transparent view of what particular programs, things like agricultural subsidies to the more important programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, are costing them over their lifetime. Because the reality is that we have strong political coalitions in government. We have strong special interest groups that achieve these spending initiatives that benefit them at the cost of the population at large. So mygovcost.org helps individuals to be able to see through some of these special interest group politics and understand the impact of changes in legislation to their personal budgets.
But to my point, but these individuals as a group, as a mob, are still addicted to the bad habits in their own personal lives that got the government in this problem in the first place. And if, you know, of course, the first step is to try to see what kind of an effect it really has on them and hopefully educate them. But that's not going to happen in the next year or two. And you're going to have to these measures or measures like them are going to have to be initiated now or in the next year or two in order to have some kind of a long-term effect. So my question, I guess, is ultimately, how do you get the mob to take the kind of action that's necessary to move the government accordingly?
Well, I think the type of demonstration that Emily's group, you know, can supply to the average American certainly goes a long way to understanding how this all relates to me. But I think we have to get back to something critical. And again, I turn into Tea Party guy again. The $111 trillion in unfunded liabilities, which is looming, you know, again, almost 10 times larger than the national debt, which is the real issue here, and which causes the rest of the world to look at us as like, I don't want to give them any money. That is totally and completely on the fact that we have wandered away from some founding principles of this country, and we started to decide that institutionalizing compassion was somehow in the public good, and we've moved totally away from anything close to compassion, and we've moved into just incredible debt, and we've weaned a whole bunch of Americans, a whole couple of generations of American, on the idea that there's a certain amount of flow that's going to come from the federal government. And like, as you pointed out earlier, like the unions in Europe, they've gotten used to that. And as soon as you try to roll back anything, or for that matter, the teachers' union in New Jersey, as soon as you try to roll back 1% of that, there's death threats. So the question is, you know, America holistically as a whole has to understand that one person's government waste is another's essential program. But at the end of the day, we're borrowing right now 37 cents on every dollar we spend. And again, just I'm watching the clock right now. We are at $56 million since the start of the show. And that's only at 37 cents on the other remaining, 63 cents that we spent. So this thing is out of control, and it's flying around, and it's public education. And then I don't disagree that it's a hard task, but there is no other task. If you look at what happened to President Obama on his recent trip, I mean, basically, he was basically told, you know, shut up, get in the corner, don't talk to us anymore. We've lost credibility. We've lost credibility as a nation, and, you know, the networks are soft-spinning it, but he was rebuked from South Korea. Now, I remember, and we just had Veterans Day. Didn't we save South Korea? And they just kind of rebuked him and said, take your $10 billion and stuff it. So,
but the burden of the package that he's bringing to them did not happen in the last 2 years.
I'm not saying it has anything to do with Obama. No, you're missing my point. It's the spending spree that we've been on for 30 years that he got stuck with the tab for. This is nothing to do with President Obama. He represented the United States of America and the full faith and credit of the United States of America, and we have destroyed the faith and we have destroyed the credit. And it's not necessarily totally the government's fault, because we, the people, have taken these things without thinking of the consequences.
Well, I think you brought up something that's very important here, is that this notion that one person's essential program is another person's wasteful spending. And this gets to the heart of interest group politics and why it is so difficult to reform any measure once it's implemented. Because from an economic standpoint, I mean, no one spends money better than the person whose money it is, right? So nobody spends somebody else's money as wisely as they would spend their own money. So when we entrust a third party to make decisions on our behalf, right, we should expect that this interest group politics will get out of control. And this is what's been going on for the last 30 years, and this is how you see accumulated deficit spending over time. The benefits of the current proposals that are on the table, from my perspective, are that they institute some changes, or they at least place on the table some rule-based policy proposals, right? So one of the fundamentals that we've gone away from in the last 50 years is rule-based policies.
Give us an example of that, please, Emily.
Well, I think that, you know, in terms of placing caps on discretionary spending measures, placing particularly legislative rules which mandate that all spending increases are financed at the time that they're passed, places a limit on.
So in layman's terms, if you want to spend money, you have to show how you're going to pay for it.
Pay as you go.
Yes. You have to pay as you go, and you have, and the particular people who are to benefit from the program have to be the same group of people that are voting on the ways in which to finance that program, right? So you're attempting to place the decision-making power in the same hands of those who will be bearing the costs, which is the problem of how the growth in spending has gotten so out of control.
Right, and we've had one example of one senator standing up and saying, wait a minute, why should we pay for this with new money when we've already allocated money to TARP? And he was run out of town on a rail in Washington, because all he said was, why do we have to go into debt for another $30 billion when we've got $436 billion sitting in the TARP fund that we haven't used yet? Why don't we use that money to pay for this bill? And he held up a key vote on a spending bill. I believe it was the extension of unemployment benefits. And he was deemed, the biggest villain in the United States, and literally run out of town on a rail, because he simply said, maybe we shouldn't incur more debt. So, again, those are the issues that we as the American public, we can't say they did it in our name and we're not responsible. You know, every Social Security, for example, is $14 trillion in the red. So everybody who talks to you and says, well, you know, we're spending $10 million or $10 billion, they're lying through their teeth. We're not spending anything. We don't have it. There is no money to spend, because they're just saying we're not paying the bills, so we have money to spend. And we all know in our personal lives that doesn't work too long. But yet we accept it from the government, because at the end of the day, we're getting something back. They're bribing us. They're paying us back prescription drug liabilities, Medicare. All these unfunded liabilities are a bribe to the public, and saying we're kicking it down the road. Well, we're down the road now. That's what when Obama went to the Asian trip, He crossed the road. We are down that road right now, and the rest of the world saying, hey, you know what? It ain't working anymore. You guys, we looked at your balance sheet. We're not going to give you any credit. We're not going to give you any money, and we're gonna think about what we've given you in the past. We're going to start tightening it up. And he wasn't talking to just President Obama. He was talking to the American people. I mean, the Chinese premier and the president of South Korea. They were talking to the American people, saying, you guys got to pull it in. And we all have to pull it in, and we have to make the political cover for our politicians by saying it's okay. We understand there's bleeding, and the bleeding must be stopped. And if we don't do that, they're just going to find another way to survive by kicking the can down the road and increasing the debt and doing all kinds of phony, trickery things. I mean, this whole commission is nothing more than political cover. And it's the third level of political cover down the funnel from what was initially supposed to be something that would trim the deficit. And we're still playing political games. And these guys, Simpson and Bowles, they're playing a part of politics as well. When, in point of fact, the patient is losing blood, you know, and again, since the beginning of the show, we are now $71 million. The debt has increased since the beginning of the show, and they're still talking.
So whether you talk about the political validity of the commission, there is substance in what they have presented in these proposals in terms of what could be done to cauterize the bleeding that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But Emily, what I want you to tell me is, are there some things that they missed? Are there some other things out there that they apparently didn't touch? Besides, obviously, you mentioned health care, but are there some other things that are out there that are being spent on that shouldn't be spent on, and that could have been included in this, but probably weren't because of politics?
Well, the healthcare legislation is the big one. The recent healthcare legislation that we just saw pass through Congress imposes taxes in a number of ways on all types of consumers, both on savings and on investment, and it also imposes government control over healthcare decisions, which, once we understand that government doesn't spend money as well as we personally do, there's reasons to be quite worried about that as we go down the line. But if you look through the actual proposals, they're quite modest, and this is perhaps where we may be in agreement, is that the cuts that they're making to aid to the states, the cuts that they're making in the defense spending and in the military growth in spending are very modest in comparison to even Obama's campaign proposals. I mean,
you're talking about the specifics of this proposal from last week.
Yes.
Yeah, but they are
actually moderate. Go ahead.
Oh yeah, they're not only they have no teeth over the long haul. I mean, they are Band-Aids on a large gaping wound. It doesn't help at all. Because I don't mean to sound like a pessimist, but you have to understand there's 535 people involved in the federal government, but there are 513,000 elected officials in the United States. They've all learned the game. They've all learned that, hey, I'm going to collect money from somebody else and give it to one special interest group that's going to guarantee my election. And they all know that game. There's a 500,000 elected officials playing that game. And they're playing that game because it works. They're playing that game because it gets them elected. They're playing that game because it's not their money. So all of these factors come in. And you got a 500,000 elected officials, and they're being elected by people who are all looking for their peace. So I go back again to what's needed is a national enema. We've all got each individual American citizen. Not the guy next to you, not those guys in Washington, but everyone listening to this right now and everyone who will ever hear it has to say, it's my responsibility. I've got to call these guys and I've got to tell them, cut spending 30%. And then however that happens, however that shakes down, is what we have to demand that. We have to demand that they figure out how to cut spending. Because if we don't give them the right to do that, they will keep backing into all of these backroom deals and interest politics, which gets you to nowhere. It gets you to incredible deficits. But it's we the people first. This is our country. And we have to rise up and we have to say, enough. Let's do this like I do my checkbook. Let's do this like I run my house. Let's do this like I run my company. Because at the end of the day, you can't pay for that which you don't have. They are lying every time they talk about an appropriations bill. They are lying through their teeth. There is no money there. We went broke $120 to $126 trillion ago if you throw in Freddie and Fannie. We're $126 trillion broke.
Sure.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to get on a soapbox there.
No. And I agree with everything that you have said. And in fact, the idea that the politicians are going to continue on this path is right. And I believe that there's a strong role for Americans to become aware of what interest group politics are and how detrimental it is to our future long-term prosperity.
Amen.
I do see, however, that, you know, the Bowles-Simpson proposal that was put forth is far from ideal. And like I said, many of the cuts are modest, and many of the cuts avoid the politically contentious issues like healthcare reform, which are critical to our nation's health in the long term. But there are some improvements that are put forth in the bill that are important in terms of looking at cuts. If you look at the actual proposal, there's a way to close the projected annual budget shortfall through 2030 mm-hmm. without raising a dollar in taxes.
Yeah.
That's quite amazing, actually. That's quite amazing considering that there's politically feasible moves within here. Now, I understand the interest group game, and I understand that there's a long way to go before any of these proposals hit the ground, and what comes out on the other end will surely be quite different than what's gone in. But I think that it's important to have these measures of how it is that we're actually going to cut spending on the table, and I'm quite pleased to see that there are many spending cuts included.
One of the things that struck me, and I've talked about this for weeks, is this whole notion of the earmarks and how that, watching this new Congress come in, that seems to me as a battleground. It's that little piece of sliver of ice between Pakistan and India that they fight over all the time. It's going to be that for Congress, this whole measure of earmarks, because when the whole discussion came up about TARP money and bailout money, Republicans stood on their heads and said no. But then you had seven Republican governors and a certain number of lawmakers who had no trouble taking the money for their individual districts or states. So it always seems to me as if doublespeak is in play when it comes to talking about the earmark. And it seems to me that eliminating the earmark, a simple thing to do, would be a very good start. Tom?
Well, I agree that we should get rid of earmarks, but not for the reason you state. The actual amount of impact on the budget of earmarks in terms of fiscal impact, probably less than 1% of everything we're talking about, believe it or not. But the problem with earmarks is that they corrupt the system, because earmarks are a way to have, as the professor pointed out, that's how your interest groups get money back from the system. So it is a corrupting influence in terms of it is nothing more than think of any earmark as the committee to reelect. That's what an earmark is. It's the committee to reelect. And all that funding, all that money, somehow or another, with the possible exception of ego in the case of John Murtha in the airport, turns into the committee to reelect. And we've already covered the election. We've already paid for that. So this is just another way for them to grab more money from the committee to reelect. So I agree with you, earmarks have to disappear, but in terms of if they have that argument for the next 6 months, they win, because it's 1% or less of the entire impact that we're talking about.
Emily, the president has to present his budget in February. If he's serious about this issue, what does he need to do?
Well, he needs to, I would say, we need to have dramatic changes in the dedicated payments to Social Security, healthcare, and Medicaid particularly the Social Security reform we see being proposed is, like I said, it's moderate. You know, they're only suggesting that we increase the eligibility age to 70 years old, and where, you know, if you look to Europe and you look to the riots in the streets of France over increasing the mandatory age by 2 years, we don't have that here in the United States, and the primary reason we don't is because the government doesn't have the same control over all employment opportunities with domestically. So you know, while the government has increased in size and scope dramatically over the last 50, 60 years, we're at a situation where reform may actually be possible. And so I think that that's an extremely crucial component of some of the proposed changes. Now, some of the other proposed changes don't go far enough. I mean, there's ideas to reduce the farm subsidies. There's ideas to eliminate, or to cut foreign aid. From an economic standpoint, there's no reason why we should be engaging in those practices at all. So we should put it on the table to completely eliminate farm subsidies, to completely eliminate foreign aid, and to make significant reductions in the scope of government employment by reducing our federal workforce by more than 10%. I mean, 10% should be a baseline.
Now, left out of this discussion is the private sector, which I find interesting, since certainly the banking piece of the private sector got billions of dollars to survive. The auto industry, billions of dollars to survive. But the private sector, during the days of prosperity, shipped 10 million jobs overseas and eroded the tax base. But they are left out of any solution for helping to fix the situation. Now, it seems to me that they need to be brought into this somehow. Tom?
Well, the reason why corporations have done that is because our tax code, and you know, this is a whole other show, but our tax code has made it more profitable for big corporations to ship work and ship jobs and ship wealth overseas, and essentially in a non-U.S. growth capacity, because of the very laws that have been enacted. So this is all stems from the same tree, which is our tax codes. I mean, there's so much in the tax codes that affects people in their daily lives, but giving corporations a license to work against the United States of America in terms of our growth, in terms of our jobs, by making it so attractive from countervening tax codes that nobody put together while they were writing it, but when a lawyer looks at it and says, hey, according to this and this, I can get away scot-free. Nobody's looked at that and come back and said, wait a minute, we just created a loophole, which is what a loophole is, that's gigantic enough for corporations to ship millions and millions of jobs and wealth creation out of the country.
So isn't that then part of the solution moving forward is to...
Only if the Congress, and you know, that one of the first things the Republicans want to do when they get in, I heard, was address those corporate tax rates and the corporate tax structure so that...
But those corporations spend billions of dollars in special interest money to keep that just the way it is, or to keep that from being changed.
But they didn't give that money to the new crop coming in. And that's where America's got to get on the board, too. That's where private citizens got to come in and say, listen, we don't want that. But there's another factor. I don't mean to dominate the thing, but there are actually people out there who, in a Keynesian sort of way, believe that running big deficits in the face of the worst economic thing you've had in 80 years is actually the right thing to do. I mean, these are diehard people who believe that the only answer for America is to run up a big deficit. We haven't talked about them at all, but they're some of your leading thinkers and leading economists, and a lot of your people in colleges and stuff that teach this kind of economic theory totally believe that deficit is the way to go. So it's not like deficits are big bad wolves everywhere. There's a large consistency and contingency, a lot of them in the government, unfortunately, who believe that in a Keynesian sort of way, you know, the general theory of employment, interest, and money, you can read the book if you can get through it, that deficits are the way to go. So you've got that head. You know, I'm not even getting to Cloward and Priven. So there's also a mindset, because, you know, it's the deficit that feeds most of the people. It's a cancer feeding and eating the host. And those
Emily.
Yes, go ahead.
Emily, you mentioned that this is a point now where we can deal with it. On this time clock, based on what's happening to other governments in the West, is there a timeline, or is there a time when this will not be manageable?
And well, it's already not manageable. It's already very unmanageable. We're facing a debt crisis that is, we will have to pay the piper eventually. So the question is, what types of reforms are possible? And, I mean, you know, I agree with our other guest that this is a very deep-seated problem. And, you know, the reforms that are on the table are only small cuts in a larger culture of debt. And, you know, private debt is fine as long as we have strong property rights enforcements, and then people are able to take risks and bear the consequences of their actions. However, governments do not have to bear the consequences of their actions in the same way. And so the trick to reform at this point is to find some way to credibly commit government to reducing its expenditure and enabling it not to grow into the future.
106.
Thank you very much, Emily. Thank you very much, Emily Scarbeck, director of MyGovCost.com, and my other guest, Tom Abatabile, activist in the Tea Party movement in the New York City area.